Mickey Mouse made his on-screen debut in 1928 with a black-and-white animated short film called Steamboat Willie. In this iconic short film, Mickey's working on a steamboat. He's whistling on the job when his big mean boss comes along and gives him what for. Mickey talks back. And from there, he gets into mischief of one kind and another in a plot that seems built to show off new tricks for animators, like when a goat swallows a guitar. And Mickey turns him into a music box. But the important thing about Steamboat Willie is that Mickey gets the last laugh. Steamboat Willie is a huge turning point in the story we've all been told about the birth of Mickey Mouse, who's been a household name in America since that movie came out. And the story of Mickey Mouse is not just the stuff of pop culture legend. It's part of Kansas City's whole mythology, because the man behind the mouse, Walt Disney, is from here. So what happens if the story of Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse as we know it is missing a few crucial details, namely the role of a major collaborator, a guy by the name of Ub Iwerks, also a Kansas Cityan, who never gets any credit for making Mickey? There's a new book about the whole sordid tale. It's called A Mouse Divided, and the author joins us now. Jeff Ryan, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
So you realize, I assume, that the story as it's been told means a lot to Kansas City. Walt Disney is one of our major exports, and that is a point of local pride.
Yes, and what's one of the weird things about the story is that there's a big fan club at Disney called D23, which is the year that Disney left Kansas City. He spent so much time celebrating what he remembered from growing up in towns like Kansas City and Marceline. Main Street USA is like walking down a Missouri town from 100 years ago. But he never kept the connections to Kansas City that you would think he would have because he spent so much time celebrating it. And I think that reflects the fact that he also lost contact with his best friend and business partner, who was a Kansas Cityan too.
So we are going to get into details in a second, but tell the Cliff Notes version of the story. Who is Ub Iwerks and what was his role in creating Mickey Mouse?
Ub and Walt met on the job. They worked at an ad agency in 1919 or so. And that job lasted about 6 weeks, but they became best friends. And they created business after business in Kansas City, and they were trying to become animators. Ultimately, they succeeded with a cartoon called Alice in Cartoonland, where Alice was a live girl in a cartoon world, which no one had ever seen before. Walt pulls Ub over to Los Angeles. They make a whole bunch of these. Then they get tired of making Alice's, so they want to make just a pure cartoon. They make Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Then Walt realizes that he doesn't own Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and so they make Mickey Mouse, which Disney does own.
Okay.
And Mickey Mouse, of course, is Pop.
And we're going to get back into the details, like I said, but this book is hilarious. At least it is to me. Were you trying to be funny?
I attempted a little bit of humor. There's a lot of people who are a lot funnier than I am, but Mickey is a funny character, so I wanted to have some humor in there too.
I want to read a blurb from the back cover. This is what it says. Almost everything you know about Mickey Mouse is wrong. He wasn't Disney's first star. Steamboat Willie wasn't his first movie. Mickey wasn't a nice guy, and Walt Disney didn't invent him. It's so dramatic.
I tried to make it dramatic, too. So there's some laughs and there's some thrills as well.
Well, can you tell the story of how you came to investigate the Mickey Mouse story?
I had written a previous book about Super Mario, and the way Super Mario was successful was Nintendo copied the Mickey Mouse blueprint and did everything they could to put Mario's face wherever it went, so when you saw one, you thought of the other. And I wanted to know how Disney made that in the first place, because I'm a pretty voracious pop culture devourer, but I had only seen 1.5 Mickey Mouse cartoons, and most people I talked to felt the same way. How can this be? How can the most popular fictional character in the world be someone that no one is a fan of and no one knows anything about?
Well, so Talk a little bit more about that, first of all, the connection between Super Mario and Mickey Mouse, because that is pretty interesting.
Mickey was the first true global star. He was, I called him the first second generation star because all of his cartoons were parodies in a sort of other cartoons, of other stories. Like Steamboat Willie is a parody of a popular Buster Keaton film, popular at the time, called Steamboat Bill Jr. People don't remember Steamboat Bill Jr. anymore, but they remember Steamboat Willie. They remember the parody.
And so... Can you connect the dots between that and Super Mario?
The connection, I would say, is that Mickey was so popular that everyone wanted to take part in anything that Mickey was a part of. And Nintendo realized the same thing. So if they were making a racing game, they would put Super Mario in there. If they were making a tennis game, they would put Super Mario in there. If they were making an exploring game, they'd put Mario in there. He became their everything.
But he also doesn't. Yeah, he also doesn't have an actual story or real like character in the way we think of characters. And that is something I never thought of before about Mickey Mouse. You write how he's this universally beloved character who has no real character. Like, who is Mickey Mouse? What is his backstory? You know, what does he want? Yeah. What does he need? We have no idea. He's just this big head with two big circles for ears.
And when I went back to watch the original Mickey Mouse cartoons, I realized that there were actually two different Mickey Mouses, depending upon who was in the driver's seat. Walt Disney's version of Mickey Mouse and Noob Iwerks' Mickey were totally different. Walt's idea was the everyman, sort of what you think of for Charlie Chaplin, the guy who was a friend to everyone and just wanted to help out. And Oob had a different idea. Oob wanted to make an action-adventure star. He wanted to copy Douglas Fairbanks and Zorro. So that was his idea of Mickey, the mouse of action. And you think those two characters really don't go together. But because they went back and forth telling the story, they did. Mickey became both the aw shucks everyman and the man of action who would charge in and save the day.
Can you give an example of where we see those two different Mickeys that people might be familiar with?
You can see both Mickeys in Steamboat Willie when he's whistling and tuning the steamboat down. That's the Walt Disney Mickey, and that's why that image shows up in front of all of the Disney films. But then when he takes a shot at Pete, and I think he kicks him in the butt, something like that, that is Oob's Mickey Mouse coming in.
So I want to get to the newly revised story that you tell of Mickey Mouse, the story of his creation as you understand it, where Mickey is actually the result of a collaboration between Walt Disney and Oob Iwerks. Can you get us up to the point where they have created a character named Oswald the Rabbit and what that moment, where that moment leaves them as a creative duo?
They've created Oswald, and they're making about $1,800 for each Oswald. Walt goes to Universal, his distributor, over in New York, and says, hey, I want a raise. And the distributor says, we're not going to give you a raise. We're going to cut your salary per Oswald cartoon by about $500 because we have hired all of your animators out from under you. We think that you are a weak link in the chain of Disney animation, that you don't do anything other than recycle old jokes. We can do that better than you can. And Walt was really flummoxed by this, partly because he had been warned about it. When Universal called all of his animators, they called Oob Iwerks. Oob was the only one who stood by Walt Disney and said, no, I'm not leaving my best friend. He brings more to this company than you realize.
So who is Oswald the Rabbit, though? Like, can you describe that character?
Oswald is basically Mickey Mouse, except he has two long ears instead of two round ears. The characters are almost identical in appearance, but Disney lost the rights to Oswald in 1928. And then they gained them back in 2006 because Disney's a much bigger company now. And it made a deal with NBC, which was owned by Universal at the time. They traded the rights to Oswald the Lucky Rabbit for Al Michaels appearing on Sunday Night Football.
Whoa. So back to the 1920s, though, Walt Disney and Oob Iwerks decide to stand together. They don't need anyone else. They're going to create their next new character on their own and they're going to own it, The Birth of Mickey Mouse comes next. And in your book, you reference an episode of Drunk History on Comedy Central that tells the story. So I looked that up and I want to play a clip now and then you can elaborate and possibly correct a few details. Derek Miller is the drunk narrator of this story and the clip picks up after the Oswald the Rabbit fiasco.
Well, it's like, we need a character up. What do you got? What about a horse? Nope. What about a dog? Nope. What about a cat? No, man, we got enough cats. We got Felix the cat. There's a lot of cats out there. What else you got? What about a mouse? Walt's like, yeah, let's do that. But what happened next was all Ub Iwerks, okay? So Ub locked himself in the studio and he churns out 600 to 700 frames a day, unheard of. He did 2 months of animation in 2 weeks and he created a character, Mickey Mouse. He sat down and drew that cartoon, plain crazy. Walt loves it, but he goes, you know what? We need something bigger. And Ub was like, what if we could sync sound to it? What if we did our next cartoon where we could see the action happening in the time with the music? And Walt was like, yeah, let's do sync sound. So Steamboat Willie comes out and it blows audiences away. They went, I can see that mouse whistling. I can hear the mouse whistling. Oh my God, this mouse is whistling along with what his mouth is doing. This f***ing sync sound.
So that is the drunk history version of how Ub Iwerks and Walt Disney both created Mickey Mouse.
That was excellent.
Okay, so I know.
The one thing I'd say that wasn't totally accurate is that sync sound was Walt's idea, not Ub's. Walt was in New York and he learned about a soundtrack system and he knew that a gimmick would sell the Mickey Mouse cartoon. So sound was going to be the gimmick.
Okay, so point of clarification, is it Ub or Oob?
Officially, it's Oob, but Walt said Ub, therefore everyone else said Ub.
Man, this guy's name was even stolen.
Yeah, it's Frisian, which is a tiny little language that came out of Germany.
Okay, so, but let's elaborate on the story that we just heard the drunken version of. I mean, first of all, this issue of, like, they're just sitting there floundering for a character, but is this real? Like, they knew that they need a cartoon animal. It's got to be an animal.
Yes, and they did cycle through not just a bunch of animals, but all of the animals that that the drunk narrator mentioned. And those all show up in the first Mickey Mouse cartoon, Plain Crazy. There's a cow, there's a horse, there's a turkey that wanders by. So Ub was very economical. All those characters he designed, he put to use right away.
And he really drew all of them.
He drew every single frame. What's even more remarkable was that all of the other Disney animators had given their 2 weeks' notice, so he was doing this in the office in secret while everyone else was drawing the final Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoon.
Man, so, I mean, it's pretty intense. The idea of a collaboration, you know, you kind of imagine, Walt, it sounds like, is the visionary, and he's, like, the driving force. In some ways, more than he's the creator.
Yes, he's the spark plug, and Ub is the engine. And that became abundantly clear when they went their separate ways a year later, because Ub was able to produce a tremendous amount of animation of incredibly high quality, very inexpensively, but it never sang to people the way that Walt Disney's animation did. And Walt was able to replace Ub with other great animators who could stand on his shoulders, but Ub could never replace Walt.
Because you do need a visionary.
Yes, you do. You do need something to say in your story.
So, but, okay, what goes wrong with this? Because in some ways, it does sound like the perfect pairing of this person who has this incredible ability to draw well, draw quickly, and really there is a brilliance in Mickey Mouse that you write about that is largely visual, a visual brilliance of these, basically, like I said, three circles, head, ear,
yes.
ear.
And And they'd been working together for 10 years without any true success. And this is their success. This is their moment when they should be reveling and enjoying it. But the stress of it affected them differently. It affected Walt particularly, where he took all of his anger out on Oob. His wife called it the Disney disposition. It was something that Walt's father had and his brother had. And people in the Disney family yelled and screamed at each other, and then on the turn of a dime, they stopped and they felt better because they had expressed their emotion. And they never needed to apologize because no one did in the family growing up. So Oob wasn't used to that. He got all of this abuse after a year and decided, I'm doing most all of the work here. I'm going to leave. You can hire other people to make your own cartoons. I'm going to make my own because I don't want to be yelled at anymore.
So... okay, this is a lot to swallow for Kansas Cityans, especially. If what you are hearing bothers you as a Kansas Cityan, call 816-235-2888. Tell us what's on your mind. Jeff Ryan, my guest, has dug deep into the Walt Disney Mickey Mouse story for his new book, A Mouse Divided, which explores the forgotten efforts of Walt's collaborator, who, by the way, was also a Kansas Cityan. Jeff, what do we do with this information? Disney's going to be Disney. I mean...
you know? Right. And they have all of these celebrations for Mickey Mouse, and everyone talks about how Walt Disney created Mickey Mouse, but he had help. There was someone else who physically drew Mickey Mouse and drew every frame of the first appearance and was Walt Disney's business partner, too. When Oob left Disney, he had a 20% stake in the company. He sold it for $3,000.
Man.
Do you want to know how much he'd be worth if he stuck around?
Yeah,
if he
I do want to know.
I'll be yelled at by Walt. He'd be worth $32 billion.
The cost of abuse is high.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the time, he thought that he could just make another fortune. He didn't know that Mickey was going to be it.
Or that, I mean, it sounds like maybe both of them didn't quite recognize the value of the other or fully acknowledge it?
I think you're right, yeah. And they only realized when they went their separate ways. When people would ask where Mickey Mouse came from, Walt couldn't tell the truth. He couldn't say, oh, my best friend made him up and he's not around anymore because I yelled at him too much. So he made up the story, which got bigger and bigger in the retelling, that first he invented it on the train going to Los Angeles. Then his wife helped. Then there was a flashback scene involving mice that he kept as pets. Then there was a pen pal where he drew Mickey Mouse to a little girl that he was friends with. The story just kept bigger and bigger. And he was a great storyteller, so it was a great story. But he would always wink when he was telling it. Like, you know, you want to believe this one? Because it was covering up the heartbreak underneath.
Let's hear from Sunny calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Sunny.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to share?
Well, I have a little information going back to Walt's early years. My uncle had a commercial art studio in Kansas City, and he employed Walt and I believe to do animation. His job was to create these slides that used to appear between double feature films, you know, advertising slots. Anyway, as the story goes, this is a family heritage, this story. As the story goes, it was just before Christmas time, and my uncle had lost a certain account that was most of their business, so he had to let some people go, and he let Walt go. And in later years, they maintained a friendship. There was no animosity there. In later years, after jumping way ahead, after Walt had become famous, my uncle had retired to California, and Walt offered him a tour of the facility. And as the story goes, Walt... Kind of obliquely offered him a position there of some sort, he said. And my uncle told him, he said, Walt, I'd be as out of place here as you were in my place in Kansas City.
This is a great story.
I have a picture in my possession taken in Walt's office with Walt, my uncle, and Ub Iwerks, and it is signed by Walt Disney to Lou Pressman.
This is great.
My first job in the art world.
Sonny, thank you. Jeff Ryan, you know, I'm sure that, like, you talk about this book in a lot of places. Talking about it to Kansas Cityans is a little different.
This is great. Someone who was a descendant from the owners of the Pesman Rubin Studio called in. That's amazing.
Well, you also can join this conversation about Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, and Ub Iwerks, also a Kansas Cityan and a forgotten collaborator, in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, 816-235-2888. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Jeff Ryan. He's written a book called A Mouse Divided, How Ub Iwerks Became Forgotten and Walt Disney Became Uncle Walt. Hi again, Jeff.
Hey, Gina.
So you are dismantling a creation story, the creation story of Mickey Mouse, or at least you're adding a whole person to that story, which makes Walt Disney more of a partner in Mickey's creation than the guy who gets all the credit. And you mention in your book that you didn't come to this as someone with any special love of the Disney lore. Can you talk to me about your relationship with Disney just as a person living in this world?
Okay. It wasn't that much of a relationship. I'm from a big family. We have four kids, and we never went to Disney World growing up. And I watched the Disney Channel a little bit, but I never saw any Mickey Mouse cartoons. So I didn't have that love ingrained that so many people do for Disney and the Disney Empire. I never saw Mary Poppins as a kid. I never... all of the big Disney touch points I wasn't part of. So I wanted to learn about that. I wanted to see what everyone else loved about Disney. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book.
So you're in some ways almost this anthropologist looking at what for most people would be like part of American culture, but for you just wasn't. It wasn't part of your frame of reference.
It wasn't part of my childhood growing up, but it was part of the American childhood. And I felt like I missed out on it. I wanted to see what I missed out on.
And so you did a lot of work in the Disney archives, or you tried to. It turns out that the Disney archives, like getting in there is almost like getting FBI clearance or something.
Yes. A lot of people want to get into the Disney vault, which is a very big, not quite organized place. So they only let people who have been researching for a very long time or are working for Disney, making something like a DVD extra. So I wasn't allowed in, but I found the next best thing, something possibly even better, which was that there was an unpublished biography of Walt Disney that was written the year after he died by a man named Richard Hubler. And this was an authorized book, but when the family read it, they said, we don't want this to go out into the world. We don't want this to be the picture of Walt. So what happens to authorized books when the family that authorizes it doesn't like it is it never comes out. So there's one copy that exists in the Disney archives, and I'm never going to read that one. But I found another one. There was another one in the Richard Hubler papers that he donated to Boston University. So I drove up to Boston for a couple of days, and I had to wear white gloves while I was reading it because these are archived documents at this point. So I was cosplaying as Mickey Mouse while I was researching Mickey Mouse.
That is pretty funny. I mean, you have dug deeper into Mickey Mouse as someone who technically wasn't obsessed than a lot of people who have been obsessed in sort of, I don't want to say an age-appropriate way, because lots of adults are also obsessed with Mickey Mouse, but like Mickey Mouse is a children's character, but you are like the grown-up who's like, I'm going to try and get this now.
Yes, I'm in my 40s and I'm writing about a character who shows up on kindergartners' backpacks. I realize that there's not many people who are doing that.
Can we talk, though, about what you see in this, as someone looking at it from the outside, that a fan might miss?
One thing I think a fan might miss is that Mickey changed over the years. He evolved. He was not a very nice guy at the beginning. There's stuff that goes on in his first cartoon, Plane Crazy, which Disney cuts out nowadays. Even in Steamboat Willie, there's a minute of footage that they cut out normally when they reshow it because Mickey Mouse wants to play on an orchestra of animals.
But I saw that version.
It's not done in a friendly way. It's done in a way where he's torturing these poor animals.
He's pulling their tails.
Yes, he's pulling their tails and he's kicking them.
I was really alarmed.
Yeah, that's what passed for humor back then, back when a lot of people had animals in their backyard and they were much more cavalier. There was no ASPCA back then.
Well, then how did Mickey change? Do you see like a Mickey turning point?
Bit by bit, people would write letters in saying, I'm a parent and my kids are acting like Mickey Mouse. You've got to knock this off. And so Walt decided to smooth off Mickey's rough edges to make him look as round as his silhouette does. And he had other animators who helped out with that in the post-UB years. And that created the Mickey Mouse that we know and love. But that also made it very hard to tell stories about Mickey Mouse because Mickey could no longer get angry at anything because he wasn't a regular person with regular emotions. Enter a certain duck in the Disney archives who was well known for being extremely angry, Donald Duck. All of the stories they couldn't tell with Mickey, they could tell with Donald because Donald was rage personified.
Well, why is it okay for Donald but not okay for Mickey? I don't get it. That didn't bother parents that the duck was mad?
I guess it didn't bother them because Donald Duck isn't heralded as a good example. No one wants to be like Donald Duck when they grow up. But Mickey is everyone's friend. Donald is like the drunk uncle in the corner who's being told, you can't smoke the cigar in here. And he's like, it's okay, I'm blowing the smoke outside. And they're like, oh, Uncle Donald.
And then the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, by the time that's in effect and Mickey's saying his whole name is M-I-C-K-E-Y-Y because I love you, then he has to be nice, right?
Yeah, then he has to be nice. And the Mickey Mouse Club, which wasn't the one in the 50s with Doreen and Annette and Cubby and the hats, that wasn't the first Mickey Mouse Club. The first one was a promotion to get kids to watch Mickey Mouse. They would get something like a punch card, and when they got 10 punches, they got a special Mickey Mouse book. And the prizes that they got for attending all the Mickey Mouse clubs kept changing. So you kept having to go back again and again to get all the new prizes. And you could go to shops in town that had orange placards up that said, we support the Mickey Mouse Club, and you could get extra punches that way. And that's really strange to think about because the local drugstore is not just supporting the local movie theater, but it's supporting the short that's running before the feature in the movie theater. That it goes backwards two or three different ways because it's advertising supporting other advertising.
That seems very prescient, actually. I mean, that's kind of the world we now live in.
Exactly. Mickey Mouse was the first citizen of the 21st century, way back when.
You also write about him as a religious figure, which I find fascinating.
It's mostly because we are, as a culture, as a society, as a species, we look to higher powers. And starting in the 20th century, fewer and fewer people went to church or synagogue. And the need for some sort of iconography was still there. And that's where Mickey Mouse came in. And we could worship him the same way that we worshiped a saint. Think about this. Look around your house and count how many images of Mickey Mouse and other Disney characters you have. And then compare it to how many people, how many representations of your religion that you have, what your belief system is. Mickey Mouse is probably going to win. If you're just looking at it from the pile of one versus a pile of another, there's more Mickey Mouse stuff in your house than what you say you believe in for spirituality.
And then also just the fact that Mickey Mouse's silhouette is this symbol that we recognize just immediately, that the meaning behind it is left a little bit open-ended, you know?
Right. That's one of the great things about icons. You don't need to know what it represents. It represents something a little different to everyone. But so long as you put it up and you have a positive feeling, it doesn't matter if everyone's feelings don't overlap in a perfect Venn diagram. It's easier if the Venn diagrams are a little separated. And I realize once again, I'm now describing the silhouette of Mickey Mouse by talking about what the Venn diagrams look like.
Well, so Okay, we've gotten pretty deep here in the whole Mickey Mouse story, but I want to get back to the story that started this whole conversation, the story of Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks, his collaborator, the collaborator who's been largely forgotten. We have a call from Mike in Lee's Summit all about Ub. Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike.
Thanks. Hey. I've known about Ub for a while because he's a alumni of Northeast High School, the same high school I went to, and that he's one of the famed, I guess, alumni of Northeast, and that I went to Northeast, but my dad went to Westport, the same high school that Walt went to at the same time. He didn't know Walt Disney, but I mean, it's kind of a coincidence there. And that the other thing is that Walt has, why the UMKC Kangaroos are called Kangaroos is that when UMKC was the University of Kansas City, Walt drew a cartoon kangaroo, and that's why UMKC are now known as the Roos.
Huh. Okay, Mike.
Wow.
Thank you so much for calling in. Mike also has a family connection, not just to one of these characters, but to both of these characters. Can you talk about, first of all, some of the early, more of that early relationship between Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks? We've heard about what happened when they were in L.A. How did their friend, they met at an animation studio here?
It was
an
art studio.
Okay.
Yes, and they had a dream not of making animation, but of making a comic strip, because Kansas City is where so much of the syndication for newspapers was. So they wanted to pitch it to King Feature Syndicate, and they had mocked up fake newspaper pages to make it look like that their comic strip had already been published elsewhere, and King was just going to pick it up, and that ended up not happening. 10 years later, though, they did get a chance with King, of all places, to make a Mickey Mouse daily comic strip, and they worked together on it. This was during 1929, when everything was falling apart, relationship-wise. So they only had a couple weeks together. Yes. Well, it's one more coincidence or irony that Disney did great all throughout the Great Depression, because it never invested in anything other than its own company, and people always had a nickel or a dime to go to the movie theater.
Wow. So that brings me to my next question, which is, whatever happened to Ub? We basically know what happened to Walt Disney and his name, but what happened to Ub later in life?
That's one of the reasons I really wanted to tell this story, because in most Disney histories, Ub Iwerks disappears when he leaves Disney, and you never hear what happens to him. So I wanted to find out. And what happened was, he became one of Walt's competitors, and he went to one of the people who helped rip Walt off back in the day, Pat Powers. And working together, Ub almost tried to topple Walt Disney, and he succeeded for about a year, and then he ran out of money, and his cartoons went from color to black and white, and then the quality went down, and people stopped caring because Disney was able to put more money and more care into their product, and there was a better story being told at Disney than at Iwerks' studio.
Does Ub have any fans? Does he have like a following, a secret cult following?
He has a massive cult following. In fact, there's a very popular video game from the last couple of years called Cuphead, where all of the characters are drawn in 1930s-style animation, and all of that is directly pulled from Ub Iwerks. So if you watch an Ub Iwerks film from the 30s and you're a fan of this video game Cuphead, you're going to think, wow, that looks just like the video game I was playing now. But it's not. It's 100% Ub Iwerks.
Jeff Ryan, author of A Mouse Divided, thank you for telling us about a famous Kansas Cityan, Ub Iwerks.
And another guy named Walt Disney, too. Thank you.
Up next, a local violinist sets the story of a bull named Ferdinand to music. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR Central Standard continues in a minute.
Thank you. Once upon a time in Spain, there was a little bull, and his name was Ferdinand.
That's the beginning of a popular children's story set to music. A local violinist has been taking Ferdinand into schools, and the public's going to have a chance to catch the show this Friday at the library. The woman behind it is here with us now to talk about the story, why it speaks to her, and how you make it musical. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Elizabeth Salane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina. Great to be here.
I know you have a lot of collaborators and you're eager to give them credit. We will get to that. But for people who don't know the story of Ferdinand, can you tell me about this lovely children's book and like what it's about, how it inspired you?
Oh, it's a classic. It was published back in 1936. And it was so inspiring that, you know, Walt Disney, who you were just talking about, made a film about it way back in 1938 and made a cartoon about it, you know, kind of like a little short film. And then again later, and it's inspired many, many tellings of the same story. So Monroe Leaf, the wonderful author, selected the character of a bull for his main, you know, his main protagonist. And then
the bull who starts as a tiny bull and grows up. And
yes, and he's forever a peaceful bull who loves to smell the flowers. He's not like all the other bulls, nor does he want to be like the other bulls. And so that idea of being a pacifist and being an individual, being different, which is celebrated in this story of Ferdinand the Bull, which has been very controversial throughout, you know, kind of throughout history. And it's amazing, the history of this book.
Tell me about some of the historic controversy.
Well, you know, it's been translated into many different languages, over 60 languages. But when it was first introduced, you know, it's supposed to take place just outside of Madrid in Spain. But Franco banned the book. And, you know, Hitler in Nazi Germany also thought it was a statement about the war. And so he also burned the book. But yet Mahatma Gandhi is to have known, and also Eleanor Roosevelt are both to have known, to have loved and cherished this book.
It's interesting because I guess the time period, the time exactly. And place when you read it, it's going to affect what you see in this whole like character of a young bull who doesn't want to fight.
Right.
In 2018 USA, I read such a statement about masculinity and assumptions about masculinity and gender.
I think that was a topic along with this book over the years, and wondering if it's questioning masculinity, having this bull, you know, to be the figurehead, but yet he only wants to smell flowers. But you know, I think it's that is kind of a ridiculous argument, and it's just a bull who is peaceful, and that must have been how Monroe Leaf felt during the time that, you know, the Civil War was about to break out in Spain, although he was in the States. So.
When you went about thinking about just the musical side of bringing Ferdinand to children, what are some moments in this story? We're going to hear a little bit of this.
Good.
And I'm wondering if you can tell us about some moments that are especially fun to make musical.
Oh, you know, Alan Riddell is the brilliant composer of this piece. It's setting the story to music. And, you know, he depicts the cow. He has a special theme just for Ferdinand. He depicts the bumblebee, and he depicts the whole parade procession into the bull ring. That's the meat of the whole story and the music, the parade into the bull ring, and then what happens afterwards. And then he has all kinds of, you know, running around, scurrying around, and virtuoso techniques you have to do on the violin.
So we're going to, you know, there's a moment that we're going to hear that is Ferdinand being stung by a bee.
Okay.
You might call this the inciting incident in this book, because Ferdinand is pretty much getting away with not fighting until he's stung by a bee and he reacts. But the stinging of the bee is dramatically performed on the violin.
Right.
Can you tell us about it?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Alan Riddell, the composer, writes a kind of a specific thing right there, but I exaggerated even more, and instead of going on the side of the bridge that you normally play on, I go on the other side, which is even screechier and squeakier, to make that effect that, you know, of course, that I know that he wants. So,
when you think about bringing this story to schools,
yeah,
Why do you think that's an important thing to do? Why this story?
Well, I mean, I'm always really curious to know how many of these generation kids have read the story still. And it's surprising to know that in some schools, none of them have read it. And in some schools, a lot of kids have read it. We went to one school where the entire school read the book before we came in, which was just fabulous. But I think it does really speak to individualism and that it's great to be different. And that's an important message for all children to know and to see this beautiful example that Monroe Leaf gives us and also to see the juxtaposition of the music with the story. Just like anything, music helps to enhance and bring to life anything that you put it with. So I think that it's a beautiful example and such modest means, one violin and one storyteller.
When you go into schools, you've talked about how familiar kids are with Ferdinand. What about classical music?
You know, whenever we do Bachreich, which is the Bach Aristotelis free education program we do in schools, we are always trying to give them things they've never seen before. And it's whether it's with a collaborator or just on our own. But, you know, they certainly have never heard this particular music by Alan Ridout before, because most people, adults, have never heard this music either. So, but with classical music, I think some of them do, they say they've been to the symphony, which is wonderful, you know, and then some of them, you know, really haven't heard any. So
what do you see in the children who haven't heard any classical music? What do you see in their responses to it?
You know, they're always really, really, you know, curious, I think, and quite fixated, because we are so close to them. And, you know, that physical proximity makes a gigantic difference in the impact that anything, you know, whether you're speaking or whether you're playing, you know, whether you're playing music. So and we do surveys. So the teachers tell us afterward the children's reactions, and we always have a Q&A, and they ask us endless questions.
Okay. Well, we're about to hear the first several minutes of a performance that our producer Sylvia Maria Gross recorded back in 2011. In this performance, the actor is Stuart Ryder. And Elizabeth, you have a new actor reading the story at the library this Friday,
yes,
right?
Yes, my friend Jorge Santizo is going to be the storyteller this Friday.
Well, let's listen back to a performance with Stuart Ryder narrating. And my guest, Elizabeth Sullane, is on violin. So you'll hear her performance that she was just describing. This is The Story of Ferdinand, set to music, and it's written by Monroe Leaf.
Once upon a time in Spain, there was a little bull, and his name was Ferdinand. He lived with would run and jump and butt their heads together. Sit just quietly and smell the flowers. He had a favorite spot in the pasture under a cork tree, and he would sit in its shade all day and smell the flowers. Sometimes his mother, who was a cow, would worry about him. "Why don't you run and play with the other little bulls and skip and butt your head?" she would say. " would shake his head. I like it better here, where I can sit just quietly and smell the flowers. And because his mother was understanding, even though she was a cow, she let him sit there and be happy. As the years went by, Ferdinand grew and grew until he was very big and strong. All the other little bulls who had grown up with him in the same pasture would fight each other all day. They would butt each other and stick each other with their horns. What they wanted most of all was to be picked in the fight, for the bullfights in Madrid. Sit just quietly under the cork tree and smell the flowers. One day, five men came in funny hats to pick the biggest, fastest, roughest bull to fight in the bullfights in Madrid. Snorting and butting, leaping and jumping, so the men would think they were the very, very, very strong and fierce and pick them. Favorite cork tree to sit down. He didn't look where he was sitting, and instead of sitting on the nice cool grass in the shade, he sat on a bumblebee. Well, if you were a bumblebee and a bull sat on you, what would you do? Wow, it hurt! It hurt! Ferdinand jumped up with a snort. He ran around, puffing and snorting, butting and pawing the ground as if he were mad. The five men saw him, and they all shouted with joy. Fastest and fiercest bull of all, just the one for the bullfights in Madrid.
And that's where we're going to end it for now. If you want to hear how that story ends with music, head to the Kansas City Public Library this Friday. The show is at 6:30. And if you can't make it, at least read the book. It is great. Elizabeth Salane, thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Gina.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for this morning's Central Standard on KCUR. You can listen back to anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. You should definitely catch the story about Walt Disney's forgotten collaborator. We talked to the author of A Mouse Divided. That's at kcur.org/centralstandard. And tomorrow, we are talking about steak. Where is your favorite Kansas City steak? Tell us about it tomorrow at 10 and tweet us your pictures, because I know you take pictures of your food. So don't be embarrassed. We are at KCUR CST. This show is produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you can keep talking to us on Twitter about anything you've heard today at KCUR CST. Up to Date is next with Steve Kraske, so don't miss it.